I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, the podcast that brings you the best NPR stories from a quarter of a century ago. It's a brand new, 25 years ago kind of world out there. And to properly orient you to the world of January 1986, here's Susan Stamberg and Noah Adams.
In 86, normal people.
Out, yuppies. That's a relief.
In, according to Nina Hyde in the Washington Post, Vanity Fair magazine, out is People magazine.
In the book Less Than Zero by Bret Easton Ellis.
Out the book Bright Lights, Big City by Jay McInerney.
In leather backpacks, out fancy tote bags.
In Mario Cuomo, out Lee Iacocca.
In Barbara Stanwyck, out Jane Wyman.
In 86, spies. Out in 86, spy novels. In the television program Moonlighting.
Yay.
Out, Remington Steele.
In, Jane Pauley.
Yay.
Out, Barbara Walters. In, John Cougar Mellencamp. Out, Bruce Springsteen.
Never.
But it says so right here on page one of the style section of the Washington Post.
In, hair spritzer. Out, hair mousse. What is this?
Only your hairdresser knows for sure.
In, steamed fish. That's good. Mm-hmm. Out, blackened fish.
I have a friend who ordered blackened red fish for the very first time at one of those New Orleans-style restaurants, and when they brought the order out to him, he said, please take it back. This fish is burned.
That's great. Well, Nina Hyde's list in the Washington Post says Cajun cooking is out in 86.
There you go. What's in?
Caribbean cooking. Want more?
Nope.
There you have it. A world without yuppies, hair mousse, and People magazine. But on the cold, sunny morning of January 28, 1986, none of that seemed to matter.
This is a special report from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Carl Castle. The worst tragedy of America's space program struck this morning at the Space Shuttle Challenger. About 1 minute after lifting off from the launch pad at Cape Canaveral, the shuttle exploded without warning. The shuttle was about 9 miles high when it blew up, sending debris scattering wildly into the Atlantic Ocean. Apparently, all 7 crew members on board were killed, including schoolteacher Krista McAuliffe of Concord, New Hampshire. The launch appeared normal until Mission Control sent the message to go with throttle up. That's the order to switch to full power. At that point, the spacecraft exploded into a huge ball of flame.
We had an apparently nominal liftoff this morning at 11:38 Eastern Time. The ascent phase appeared normal through approximately the completion of the roll program and throttle down and engine throttle back to 104%. At that point, we had an apparent explosion. There were no anomalous indications, no indications of problems with the engines or with the SRBs or with any of the other systems at that moment through the point at which we lost data.
Just a few minutes ago, Mission Control said that rescue crews are now in place and operations are underway. Just moments after liftoff, spectators reportedly sensed something was wrong. Len Ellis was among those gathered to view the launch, which had been delayed repeatedly this morning. Ellis gives us this eyewitness account.
Everybody was thrilled. People were talking about it. You should have seen it at night, etc. A marvelous thing to behold. And all of a sudden, we looked, and there was this explosion and white steam and clouds, and instead of one trajectory, there seemed to be two. It split off. It was a U-shape heading up, and someone says, that's not right. It's not going up right.
Krista McAuliffe's husband, Stephen, and her 2 small children were among the spectators on hand to view the launch. President Reagan was getting ready for tonight's State of the Union address when he was given the news. We have more from NPR's Brenda Wilson at the White House.
According to White House spokesman Larry Speaks, President Reagan was in the Oval Office with senior staff preparing for a meeting with network correspondents on the budget and tonight's State of the Union address when the explosion on the space shuttle occurred.
The vice president and the foreign policy advisor, John Poindexter, came in with others and informed the president that the news had just broken. We immediately adjourned our Oval Office meeting and went into an adjoining room, the president's study, where there's a television. And the president then began to review television reports of the explosion there shortly after the launch.
Speaks said the president watched in stunned silence. He said his emotions were very evident. Speaks described President Reagan as deeply concerned, shocked, and saddened by what he had seen. He's anxious to have more information, since at this time the White House knows no more than the public. The president's top priority and concern is for the crew. It was President Reagan who initially decided that the first citizen to be sent aboard a space shuttle should be a teacher, so it is understandable that he should feel some special link to Christa McAuliffe, who was aboard the space shuttle when it exploded. At the White House, I'm Brenda Wilson reporting.
When news of the shuttle accident reached Capitol Hill, members of Congress halted their work. NPR's Cokie Roberts is in the House chamber.
When the Speaker of the House of Representatives heard the news about the space shuttle, he called off his daily press conference, and Tip O'Neill convened the House of Representatives only long enough for the chaplain, Reverend William Ford, to offer a prayer.
And at this special moment, let us remember in silent prayer those who were involved in the spacecraft shuttle accident just a few minutes ago off Florida. Let us pray. May your spirit, O Lord, be with them, and may your love follow them and their families this day and every day, we pray. Amen.
Both houses of Congress are now in recess. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
On the day of the shuttle disaster, Wendy Kaufman filed this report for All Things Considered on the history of safety advances in the space program.
The early days of the U.S. space program were perhaps the toughest. Lots of unmanned rockets blew up on the launch pad. The first big scare for the manned space program came during the 1966 Gemini 8 mission. The two-man space capsule went into a spin, and the crew had to make an emergency ditching in the ocean. Then came the January 1967 accident. Astronauts Edward White, Roger Chaffee, and Virgil Gus Grissom, one of the original seven astronauts, were killed in a fire inside their Apollo capsule that was sitting atop an unfueled rocket 218 feet above the launch pad. For 13 frantic seconds, the crew fought unsuccessfully to open the capsule's single hatch. The astronauts had no chance in the pure oxygen atmosphere. A board of inquiry was appointed by NASA to determine the cause, the conclusion, design flaws. Subsequently, the hatch of the capsule was redesigned to open outward rather than inward, and according to space expert Mark Chartrand, other changes were made.
They changed the some of the insulation and the routing. They changed test procedures, and they changed the atmosphere in the Apollo cabin. A lot was done there.
All went relatively smoothly for the next 3 years, and then an oxygen tank in Apollo 13's command ship exploded en route to the moon. The three-man crew had to make a dramatic loop around the moon using the lunar module oxygen and power. Though the oxygen supplies were dwindling, the crew landed safely in the Pacific Ocean. Those early space vehicles, like Apollo, were nothing like the computerized flying machines of today. The shuttle is the most sophisticated spacecraft on the globe. Computers monitor everything, every valve, every moving part, the temperatures and the pressures. The computers feed themselves data and feed the information to flight controllers at the Space Center. During a recent launch, for example, the computers shut down the engines just seconds before liftoff. The shuttle has multiple and redundant safety systems, backup systems for backup systems. There are contingency plans for an accident. There are alternative landing sites around the globe. There are procedures for an ocean ditching. There is a way for the shuttle to separate itself from its rockets and fuel tanks in an emergency. And there is even an emergency transfer capsule in the event something goes wrong in space. But, says space expert Mark Chartrand, getting into space aboard a space vehicle remains dangerous business.
It has to be very powerful to reach orbit, to carry 65,000 pounds of payload into orbit. And you've got millions of pounds of thrust coming out of the two solid rocket boosters and the three main engines of the shuttle itself. And you're sitting right next to thousands and thousands of gallons of two of the most powerful propellants we know of, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen.
The liquid hydrogen and oxygen is flowing at about 250,000 gallons a second. The best safety precaution, says Chartrand, is checking and double and triple checking every system on the spacecraft, because despite all the backup systems and all the contingency plans, some accidents, like today's, are simply not survivable.
You saw the speed with which this happened. I mean, it was all over in 2 seconds. And even a more controlled failure, a more controlled failure would have perhaps allowed them to try to ditch the shuttle or something if they had the warning it was going to happen. But this was an explosion.
There will, of course, be a full-scale accounting of today's accident. But Chartrand reminds us that as we push back the frontiers of space, we take bigger and bigger risks. I'm Wendy Kaufman reporting.
I had kind of a lump in my throat, not quite as bad as when President Kennedy was shot, but pretty close.
I was shocked. I was saddened. You know, I was horrified at the accident. I thought about the teacher and her family. You know, you always think of the astronauts and the risks they're taking, and it's part of the job. But, you know, she was just an everyday person, a teacher, and you felt for her family and her children.
After all those accidents or malfunctions, I almost seen it coming.
I was just stunned. I was stunned. I couldn't continue with my work. It was terrible.
People in Los Angeles this afternoon talking about the explosion of the Shuttle Challenger.
Just days after the Challenger disaster, NPR reporters Howard Berkus and Danny Zwerdling got an anonymous tip that Morton Thiokol's rocket engineers had tried to stop the launch. Working together, Zwerdling and Berkus found the engineers, got them to talk, and broke the story behind the disaster. Here's Danny Zwerdling talking to Susan Stamberg in February of 86.
The day before the shuttle was scheduled to take off, about a dozen Thiokol engineers and four top Thiokol managers had a big conference call with NASA officials. The engineers presented all sorts of charts and drawings and photographs suggesting that the seals would fail in the temperatures at the Cape. Mm-hmm. And to the end, even when their top managers decided to agree with NASA and go ahead and launch the shuttle, the engineers vehemently objected.
What was the engineers' response then to NASA being in a position in which they're ignoring the advice that they're getting from Thiokol?
The engineers who our colleague Howard Berkus and I talked to said they were shocked. Here were the engineers saying, do not launch the shuttle tomorrow. It's too cold. Wait till the weather gets a lot warmer. But according to one participant, NASA's number two man in the shuttle program at the Marshall Space Flight Center, Lawrence Malloy, he said over the conference call, my God, Thiokol, when do you want me to launch? Next April? This is a very unusual attitude for NASA. Usually NASA is extremely conservative about these launches. In the days before a shuttle takeoff, NASA officials will grill the engineers at Morton Thiokol and its other contractors. It acts like a gadfly. It says to the contractors, prove to us that the shuttle is really safe to take off. And everyone in the space program has really respected NASA for this. But this time, the engineers say, NASA really stood that policy on its head.
And what are you hearing about the possible reasons for that now, Danny? If NASA's pushing for a launch that the engineers are warning was risky, and NASA has that reputation for being rather careful, very conservative, what happened?
Well, we can't answer it. We can only ask questions. Was NASA feeling too pressured because its shuttle program was falling way behind schedule? Obviously, that's what the Presidential Commission is asking. But another interesting question is, why did the top managers at Morton Thiokol, including some who originally went along with the engineers and urged NASA not to go ahead with the launch, why did those managers finally change their minds, despite the engineers' objections, and say, okay, we'll approve it? Mm-hmm. As a couple engineers said to us, there's tremendous pressure on Thiokol right now. In the past, the company's enjoyed a monopoly over building these rocket boosters, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of business. But now, for the first time, Susan, NASA has announced it's going to put future shuttle flights open for bid, which means other corporations might take that away from Morton Thiokol. So, one engineer told me, when your biggest customer, NASA, is saying to you at night, at 8:30 at night, we want to launch the next morning, do you want to be the contractor to say no and risk angering them, perhaps, and losing all that business?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Thiokol managers, top managers, will not talk with us, and so I don't have what they have to say.
In the meantime, though, the officials at NASA are saying they still are not certain what it was that caused the explosion. It could turn out it wasn't the rocket seals, after all. So doesn't that end up with Morton Thiokol sort of making a big fuss over nothing?
Well, you know, I asked that same question to Morton Thiokol's sources, and they strenuously answer, no way. As one source told me, I fought like hell, he said, to stop that launch, and I would do it all over again. Why? Because he says, look, maybe it will turn out that the seals weren't the cause. But, he says, at the time, that day before the launch, he and other engineers at Morton Thiokol had good evidence to have reasonable doubt, to not be sure that it was safe. And he says, when you're in doubt, you say no. You stop the launch. You err on the side of safety. Especially, he said, and at this point, he got tears in his eyes, especially, he said, when you remember there were seven men and women aboard.
NPR's Daniel Zwirtling.
Roger Beaujolais was one of the Morton Thiokol engineers who had made repeated attempts to warn NASA and Morton Thiokol about the faulty O-rings, which we know now were the cause for the shuttle explosion. A year after the shuttle disaster, Beaujolais agreed to talk to reporter Howard Berkus.
Roger Beaujolais walks out onto a redwood deck behind his Willard, Utah home. Beaujolais is still coping with anger, frustration, guilt. He had tried for years to get NASA and Morton Thiokol managers to redesign O-ring seals used in the space shuttle's solid rocket boosters. Some at Thiokol labeled him a complainer. On the eve of the last shuttle launch, Beaujolais was warning or complaining again. He and four other key Thiokol engineers presented data showing the seals might unseal in cold morning temperatures. The engineers were overruled by their managers. The launch went ahead. The Challenger exploded.
I had a hard time sleeping at night. I was having nightmares, and I was carrying my emotions on my sleeve at that time. I started to come down with real severe physical problems in the beginning of April. It culminated in a couple of real severe cases of double vision, and I had a terrible band of headache in my forehead, and that band kept getting more difficult and more severe and more difficult to handle.
Through all this, Beaujolais was first part of the effort to find out why the Challenger exploded, but Morton Thiokol moved him and other engineers aside, saying their opposition to the launch now made their contact with NASA difficult. Beaujolais' colleagues say he broke down several times at work. Therapists were called in. Beaujolais was eventually given disability leave. Before that, though, he became a key witness before the Presidential Commission investigating the Challenger explosion. During our interview, he slowly moves back into the corner of a couch, and occasionally tears form in the corners of his eyes.
I'm very angry that nobody listened. Still angry that they didn't listen. I have flashes still. I've wondered if I could have done anything different, but the comfort that I have as a result of asking myself that question is that no, there's nothing I could have done further, even to the point of getting fired that night, because you have to realize that we were talking to the right people. We were talking to people that had the authority. We were talking to people that had the power to stop the launch.
Beaujolais says the investigation conducted by the President's Shuttle Commission did not answer what may be the biggest question about that launch decision. It is a question he poses again and again in interviews, in speeches he now gives at colleges, and in a series of lawsuits and claims filed against NASA and Morton Thiokol.
Why was the Challenger launched? Why was there an apparent, well, it wasn't apparent, it was very obvious, change in attitude from NASA's standpoint to get that flight up? I mean, we were put in the position of proving that it was not safe to launch. That was totally unheard of before this flight. We were always being put in the position as a contractor of proving that it was safe to launch.
Beaujolais believes that NASA felt the pressure of repeated delays in its launch schedule. He believes Thiokol managers were worried about losing space shuttle business. Both NASA and Thiokol deny those charges.
This all leads to the fact of accountability. And to this point in time, there's been no accountability. There's been no accountability at Morton Thiokol. There's been no accountability at NASA. And I think in order to prevent something like this from ever occurring again, you have to have accountability.
That, Beaujolais says, is the purpose of his claims and lawsuits, which seek billions of dollars in damages.
And that's to send a message to the company in specific and to all company executives and in general, that they better think twice about making unethical decisions based on company positions that are not necessarily ethical or moral, and they better think twice about ruining people's lives and careers and just indiscriminately killing people with their decisions.
Beaujolais unfolds his arms but doesn't seem to relax at all. We end our interview. Beaujolais spends his days now fielding calls and interview requests from reporters. He consults his attorney about his lawsuit. He walks every day on the hilly streets near his home, and he occasionally speaks to college students, encouraging them to speak out, to consider the ethical implications of what they do, and to always fight for what they believe is right. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Howard Berkus, Danny Zwirtling, Susan Stamberg, Carl Castle, Wendy Kaufman, all bringing us truly extraordinary coverage of the Challenger shuttle disaster. This month for playback service above and beyond the call of duty, go out to Mr. Michael Katziff. Next month, we have a hard-hitting investigative report on the recall of a shipment of tainted brie. Brie as in cheese. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.